Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, let's do it again. It's time to improve your American English speaking skills. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Listen carefully, print the words we say, and download the audio. Then you can listen and read along over and over. Today we will talk about the American Space Agency as it helps people in Southeast Asia deal with weather problems. Then we have something for nature lovers. Some of the fastest animals on the planet have had scientists wondering how they can move like that and how much energy it takes. Weather in Asia and cheetahs are on this edition of As It Is. Satellite imagery from the United States is expected to soon begin helping about 60 million people in the lower Mekong River basin of Southeast Asia. The goal is to help the people deal with natural disasters and challenges of climate change. The project adds to existing programs of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. As we hear from Jonathan Evans, NASA is currently helping communities in South America, Africa, and South Asia.
The U.S.-led project brings together the lower Mekong nations of Vietnam, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. The area faces growing challenges from rising temperatures on our planet. Environmental activists say these problems include issues over water use, destruction of forests, floods, and disaster mitigation, reducing the effect of disasters. The United Nations Office of Disaster Risk Reduction says costs from natural disasters are rising. It also says that from 2000 to 2012, the estimated cost of climate-related disasters was $1.7 billion. The UN agency says 1.2 million people died in the disasters. Almost 3 billion others were affected. The U.S. development agency USAID will help support NASA in the 5-year project. They will work with local partners, including the Asian Disaster Preparedness Center based in Thailand. Gabriel Iglesias serves as a project officer with the Preparedness Center. She says the goal is to report to communities about changing conditions and help them use the information effectively.
This project will be addressing both those steps, the development of the tools to process the information, the satellite obtained data, and then to raise the capacity for decision makers to understand and interpret the results of these analyses for use in their own decision making over land use, environmental protection, adaptation, and so on.
USAID officials say the information will go to a number of experts. They include scientists, government representatives, national resource managers, and disaster response specialists. The officials say their purpose was to more effectively provide support to areas with the most immediate need after natural disasters. The costs of getting such satellite imagery have dropped sharply in recent years. That has made the data more easily available. Such information proves especially valuable immediately after natural disasters. In 2008, Cyclone Nargis struck the Irrawaddy Delta area of Myanmar. More than 130,000 people died in that storm. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. In 1900, about 100,000 cheetahs lived in the world. Today, there are only 10,000 of the animals. Just about everyone knows that cheetahs are fast. Some studies have measured their speed at about 95 kilometers an hour. So it seems reasonable that all that sprinting would rob the wild cheetah of some of its energy. But until recently, no one ever really measured how much energy a cheetah uses to move that fast. We asked Bob Doty to give us the latest research.
John Wilson took part in the cheetah research. He says cheetahs can easily deal with those energy outbursts.
Like any cat, basically, they rest for most of the day, and they have only brief periods of activity. So, for example, a cheetah would only hunt in the morning for a few hours, in the afternoon for a few hours. We assume they expend a lot of energy during these chases. They offset those high energy expenditures by resting for most of the day. So these blistering speeds that they run for short periods don't really have an effect on the cheetahs over the entire day.
But if the cheetahs are not out of breath or weak after the chase, what causes their population to decrease? Some experts say other predators, like lions or hyenas, might be stealing most of the cheetah's food after they make a kill. Dr. Wilson said the new study found that is not what really happens.
Our study has found that that's actually not really the case. Cheetahs lose about 12% of the food. So while they lose quite a bit of their food, cheetahs are pretty fast eaters, so they've eaten a lot of the food before they lose that food. The act of losing food is not that significant.
It appears that the cheetah is vulnerable to attacks by other animals because of its physiology, the way its body operates. The cat simply burns a lot of calories, the energy produced by food.
Because this cheetah have fast metabolism, they have huge lungs and a strong heart, their resting metabolic rate is really high. So just the act of walking already for a cheetah is pretty expensive. And then the longer they look for food, the more energy they need to invest in finding the food.
And he says that is the problem. It takes a lot longer for cheetahs to find animals they can catch and eat. And they have to walk a lot farther to do so. Mr. Wilson says that is because they naturally avoid people. But human beings are increasingly occupying the areas where cheetahs traditionally look for food. Houses and fences block them from searching for animals to attack. Cheetahs use up a lot of energy to get around these barriers. Mr. Wilson says that while this has not affected the number of cheetah cubs being born, it can affect their survival. He remembers seeing a female cheetah in a desert.
This mom is under stress already looking for food for herself. Then she needs to look for food for a cub. And if she needs to move further and further, the mother is under more strain, and then that puts even more strain on the cub.
He says people are also killing the animals that cheetahs hunt. People also capture and sell cheetahs in the Middle East as pets. However, the wildlife group Born Free USA says up to 70% of the cheetah cubs illegally transported through East Africa die. Earlier this year, the group called on members of the CITES Treaty to increase enforcement at borders and to improve laws and rules. Mr. Wilson says there are no easy solutions to help cheetahs deal with human activity, but fast action is needed. He says there is a 10% chance that the animals could disappear forever within 100 years. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lists cheetahs as an endangered species, and the International Union for Conservation of Nature describes the cats as vulnerable. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Today we welcome a return visit from Jennifer Ahern Dodson, Assistant Professor of the Practice in Writing Studies at Duke University in North Carolina. Ms. Ahern Dodson serves as Outreach Director and Language Arts and Media Program Director for the university's Thompson Writing Program. She helps many students and professors organize writing groups. Jennifer Ahern Dodson says that probably everyone has had difficulty writing an essay or paper at some time. She says, when writing seems easy, it is usually because he or she has something important to say. Today, she provides some tips about how to get those important points into the computer. Suppose you have done some research for your paper, but you still have more research to do. Ms. Ahern Dodson says try some writing before you're ready to write the complete paper.
Don't wait till you've done all the research for the research paper or you've figured out in your head exactly what you want to say before you get started. Sometimes just stopping in the middle, writing something about where you are at that moment, you can discover your ideas and think about what you want to express or understand.
The teacher advises that you note what information other people may already have presented about the subject. And she urges you not to get discouraged if you find that others have seemed to have used a lot of that information.
There's so much research that's been done already that it can be intimidating once we start figuring out, well, what have other people said about my topic? And so we might just keep researching and never stop and say, well, what do I have to contribute? People have said everything already.
Instead, she suggests taking some time to think about what you're noticing in the research. What points and thoughts of your own might you develop?
You don't have to be an expert on everything. What is it that you find interesting in the middle of this process?
This should help you decide what you want to write in answer to what others have said. Or it can help you decide what additional research you might need if you are dealing with the subject in a different way from others. As you progress, Ms. Ahern Dodson strongly advises working with other writers.
Who can give me good feedback on my ideas as I'm developing them and to not make me feel like I'm alone in the universe? So much of our anxiety about writing stems from sharing our writing in high-stakes situations, submitting to a college, turning in a paper at the end, and we cannot really do anything about it once we submit it.
She spends a lot of her time helping students and professors form writing groups. She says the reaction of others can tell you if you are communicating your ideas. It can show if your writing is interesting.
Better to find out that no one really is interested in that one paragraph before you submit it than after you submit it.
And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report for today. Coming soon, all about writing groups. I'm Jerry.
Thank you. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something. They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky. They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. Another 35,000, under the command of Don Buell, were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell, 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise to the Union Army. Union officers had refused to believe reports that Johnston was on the move. They said his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. but in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery. Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a Southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate Army retreated. The Union Army let it go.
Shiloh. The word itself came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, it was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again. The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory, but joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, "I cannot do without this man. He fights." We will continue our story of the Civil War next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our programs at twitter.com/voalearnenglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.